Good.
Okay, everyone, welcome. Thank you all for coming. Today's topic is the collective consciousness and being a spiritual trailblazer and what that means, but it'll all make sense soon. Let's see, where to start? In the early 20th century, in the early 1900s, they did a famous experiment in the Pacific Ocean where they took a whole bunch of monkeys, and these monkeys ate sweet potatoes. It was part of their diet, and these monkeys were totally isolated on an island, and the idea was, because monkeys have the characteristic that they mimic what they see, so they're easy to train to do odd things, and they would crack open, I don't know, their sweet potato by hitting it against a rock. And so they took one monkey out of the population of monkeys, and they showed this monkey how to cut, to use a stone as a knife, to in a human way, to cut open their food before eating it. And this was, they taught one monkey, but the experiment was to see how quickly that behavior would be introduced into the whole population of monkeys of that island. So they come into the island, and the scientists take one of the monkeys, they train it to do this unusual behavior, and then they send it back into the population, and the experiment, I guess, was a success. The monkey teaches the other monkeys this human and behavior, which is unusual for monkeys. But and that was the experiment, and that's what they wanted to look at and to see. But what was very interesting is that there was another island in that cluster of islands in the Pacific Ocean that was too far to have any physical connectivity with the original island, but it also had a population of monkeys. And there was no way that a monkey could swim from one place to another. There was no way that sound could carry from one island to another. The distance was just too vast. And yet, the monkeys in the other, in this other island started exhibiting this unusual behavior as well. And before long, all the monkey population in the area were doing that. And then there were reports from a zoo in Russia that monkeys were exhibiting this behavior. And that was an unintended consequence of this experiment, that all the monkeys of that species, all the members of that species of monkeys, no matter where they were in the world, all absorbed and assimilated this behavior into their, which was unusual for monkeys. And that, of course...
Is this a true story?
This is an absolutely true story. It's on the internet, it must be true.
Where?
I mean, I don't know, I only make up true stories, I told you that before. But, the truth is, I don't know the veracity of it, but somebody told me about this many years ago. He's a zoologist, and he told me about this experiment, and I was fascinated by it, and so I did Google it and found what I've told you, but I cannot vouch for how accurate it is, but that's the story. Anyway, it's a great story, and it dovetails certainly with a modern experiment. Okay, since we start in the scientific world, I will tell you about something called the Global Consciousness Project, and it's an experiment that's run or headquartered in Princeton. They have their main server in Princeton, and it's been going now for about 15 years, and it's a fascinating experiment which has caused a lot of controversy and a lot of discussion in the scientific world. And this is real. this is true. And the experiment is basically as follows. They have about now 70 locations in the world, including here in Australia and all over the world, where they have what they call eggs. I don't know, they're trying to make up the terminology, but they have these eggs. And what an egg is basically it's a computer which generates or computer or machine that generates random numbers. It's a random number generator. Now, you know that if you take a coin and you flip the coin, and it will land roughly, if you flip it 100 times, you don't know where it's going to land, heads or tails. And mathematically, I suppose it's possible it could land 100 times on heads and none on tails, or 100 times on tails and none on heads. But probably, statistically, the law of averages says that it's going to land more or less 50 times on heads and 50 times on tails. That's it, you know. So the problem is that, it's not the problem, if there's a deviation, if it's a little bit off the 50%, then that is something that's statistically significant, because it really should, if you have two options and they're totally random, it should be about, there's a 50-50 chance that it's going to be heads or tails. Now, there are some interesting experiments that have shown that if a person, a human being, sits in front of a random number generator, RNG, in the parlance of this global consciousness project, if you sit in front of an RNG, a random number generator, and you think to yourself, you know, heads, 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 it actually skews it towards heads, even though it's perfectly random, and this has been repeated many, many hundreds of thousands of times, and it almost always produces the same result, that human intention can mess with a purely random number generator.
That's crazy.
Which is crazy, isn't it? And again, there's a lot of debate in scientific society, because it really probably violates every law of physics but not necessarily the law of quantum physics, but it's just, yeah, quantum physics, yeah. Might not violate, but you know, certainly there's a lot of scientific axioms are broken by this, but it's quite a well documented phenomenon.
In front of a computer, is it sitting in front of a computer, or is it sitting in front of someone flipping a coin?
It's a machine. I don't know if it's a computer. I'm not sure exactly how they generate the random numbers, because it's really got to be random. So I'm not sure what, but it's a pretty sophisticated random number generator that they've created.
But
I'm sure it has some kind of a computer.
But that's not normal, because thoughts are very powerful, and we do know that thoughts are powerful. So I'm not actually
Okay, I'm on your page, but many scientists find that surprising. Let me tell you, I'm telling you from personal experience here. So this is the Global Consciousness Project. What they did is, I forget the name of the chief scientist who's behind the experiment, they set up 70 random number generators all over the world, and it's been going for about 15 years now. So they set these things up in the world, and there's a certain, you know, because if it's a 0 or a 1, if it's a heads or a tails, we know that we should get about a 50% on one and 50% on another. Now, these random number generators generate a random number every second, one random number every second every day, and they know that there's a certain deviance that's statistically acceptable, so you might get 51 to 49 flips of the coin if it's purely random, you know, and there's a certain tolerance that's acceptable. And every now and then, the thing jumps out of tolerance. In other words, it's swaying too much to heads or too much to tails, and that's an anomaly. And obviously, all this data is crunched. Actually, I understand that it was one. No, sorry, I'm getting confused between two experiments. No, so all this data comes back to this big server in Princeton, and from all these eggs, as they call them, and it crunches these data. Then they.
Is it one egg at a time which goes funny, or is it all the eggs?
Oh, so that's the thing. And then they analyze the data, right? And the funny thing is that all the eggs deviate at the same time. Even though there's no correlation, there's no connectivity between any of the eggs, they're all supposed to be totally random. And what's more intriguing, they correlate between big events in the world, events that seem to engage a lot of human beings. So for example, the biggest single deviation they've ever had was 9/11. What's even more fascinating to me is that it was 4 a.m. New York time, 9/11. So it actually predicted 9. If I mean, a lot of ifs over here. If indeed, as some people theorize, that that what this global consciousness project is proving is that there is some kind of a global consciousness, and when we all are thinking about a certain event, or many people's minds are focused on a certain event, that is somehow interfering with the randomness of the data. So if there is such a thing, if that theory is correct, which I happen to believe it is, and I'll tell you why in a moment, why I believe that's true, then it makes sense that when an event that galvanizes everybody's attention and grabs everyone's attention will have this possible effect on the data and make the variance of it.
But then how can this system predict events if, I mean, if it hasn't happened yet and not many people are thinking about it except for the
Correct.
Guys who are playing?
Yeah, that's
like
fascinating.
20 people or something.
Correct. Fascinating question. That is a fascinating question. There's another experiment, I didn't want to mention it now, but there's another very famous experiment where there's a screen with two areas in it, and they will remove the cover on the screen, and randomly there will either be a picture on the right side or on the left side. And they ask the subject to predict where the picture is going to be. And as you would expect, people are wrong about 50% of the time, or whatever. You know, it's within what the statistical expectation is. So if you say, I think the next one's going to be on the right, then they remove the two things and it's on the left, so I'm wrong. Then I say, I think it's going to be on the right, and it is on the right, then I'm right. You know, so within there's a certain expected statistical valid, you know, how many times people are going to choose. But what's very interesting is, if they put an erotic picture behind one of the two, then people's ability to predict that the picture is going to be behind that one goes up statistically significantly.
Okay.
So we actually can... Well...
Just man or woman?
Man or woman, both. It's gender neutral. So basically the idea is that there's... a theory that I read, which seems to make a lot of sense, is that time is not as fixed as we think it is. And you know, our regular perspective on time is that it's a pretty fixed thing, and you know, we're bound to the present. You can't go back to the past. You can't see what's in the future. But probably that view is not entirely accurate, and there's more bending. Time is more flexible than we think, and probably as a survival mechanism, we have built in ourselves we've kind of subconsciously figured out how to time travel when it comes to this. So there is a statistically significant predictability if it's an erotic picture. But that was definitely a digression I did not intend to make. Let me tell you why I believe that there's a global consciousness. Because there's this fascinating story about Rabbi Yosef Cairo. Rabbi Yosef Cairo was famous for writing, authoring the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. So in Judaism, you know, we have a Talmud, and the Talmud is not a very organized book. It's very much almost as if somebody had a tape recorder in the yeshivas 2,000 years ago, and they were recording the conversation. And as human conversation goes, as we just saw a great example of that right now, while we speak about one topic and then something else comes up, so you like kind of think, oh, well, let me just tell you that, and you go on a tangent onto another topic, and that's how the Talmud goes. So if you wanted to learn the laws of Hanukkah, the festival of Hanukkah, you wanted to know about Hanukkah, so where would you look for it? There is no tractate of the 60 tractates in the Talmud. There is no tractate called Hanukkah, right? There's a tractate called Megillah, which is about the Purim story. But there's no tractate about Hanukkah. So where would you look? So I'll tell you, I happen to know the answer to this one. It's in the tractate of Shabbat, because when it speaks about Shabbat candles, okay, Hanukkah. Now the time we light candles, right? And it goes on to a tangential discussion. And most of what is in Talmudic literature about Hanukkah you can find in the tractate on Shabbat. Which is a problem if you don't spend your whole life learning Talmud and don't know where everything is in the Talmud. So where do you find it? So to address that, there were different people. Maimonides was a very famous codifier who indexed the Talmud. So he went through the whole Talmud and he took the final halachic conclusions of every discussion, because the Talmud also is a discussion, so it's not necessarily conclusive. He concluded it and he created his Mishneh Torah, and then based on that, the Shulchan Aruch was written by Rabbi Yosef Kaira. So that's just an introduction to who Rabbi Yosef Kaira was, very famous and illustrious personality in Jewish history. Now, he was also a great teacher. You know, besides author, he was also a fantastic teacher, and he had many thousands of students, and he would give these very large public lectures to his students. Now, he had a problem in a problem in Jewish law that had bothered him for many years. Now, you can imagine that this mind, which was like the superhuman mind, right, being applied to a particular problem in Jewish law for many, many years. He saw a contradiction between one place and another, whatever it was. From the story, we don't know exactly what the contradiction was, but something was bothering him. And he spent years of his life, years, trying to intellectually resolve this problem. And finally, he had that eureka moment, and he resolved the problem. So he figured this will make a great class. So he gets all his students together, and they assemble, you know, thousands of people, and he stands up. So this is the format of the class. He's going to pose the question. And some people are going to give answers, similar to the answers that he thought of along the way. And he will dismiss the answers in the same way that he dismissed these answers that he came, and then finally he'll give the final answer that he came to. So he proposes the question. And there, you know, there's you know, the guy sits at the back of the class. So, you know, so that's where I used to sit. You know, not the brightest, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, as somebody once said. He sits over there, and, you know, so the great Rabbi Yosef Kaira says, does anybody know how to answer this problem, this question? And one guy, he's like, yeah, I got the answer, the guy in the back. Not somebody you would expect to come up with an answer. So everybody's like, gets a chuckle, a murmur, they all look to him and they say, what's the answer? And he gives the final answer that Rabbi Yosef Kaira had worked for decades to, or whatever, for years and years, to get to this answer. So he does, I guess, what any good teacher at that point would do. He dismisses the class, and he is very, very upset, because he doesn't understand why it seems that heaven had withheld this knowledge from him, even though this knowledge seems to be, everybody has access to it, even the guy sitting in the back of the class. So he comes, so he does what, he was a mystic also, and he performs a dream quest. What's a dream quest? Basically, you take some parchment, you write the names of the angels that convey dreams at night, you put the parchment under your head, you go to sleep. He sleeps, and then he wakes up, you wake up in the morning, you put a little parchment and a quilt next to your bed, you wake up in the morning, and in your own handwriting, you see the answer to some problem that was bothering you.
That's cool.
It's really cool, yeah. I've never done it, but it sounds really cool. Yeah, so he does this dream quest. You have to be a very high mystic to do this. But he was. He does this dream quest. He puts the thing under his pillow. The next morning he wakes up and he sees the answer written in his own hand next to his bed. And what does it say? It says like this: don't feel dejected. Don't feel down or depressed or upset that you weren't able to solve this. It's because this problem was not able to be solved in the world. The world did not possess the wisdom to be able to resolve this issue. So you worked on it, and you brought that wisdom into the world. To be the first, to be the trailblazer, to be the one who is going to take that wisdom into the world, this takes a man of your caliber. But once that knowledge is in the world, once you've done the hard work to bring it down into the collective consciousness, now everybody has access to it. Now everyone can, you know, I remember when there was a big, when was it, in the 80s, there was a big rush to be the first laboratory to isolate the HIV virus, to actually isolate the HIV virus. And there were laboratories in the States and in Europe, all over the world, trying to be the first, because it was a great feather to have in your cap that you were the one who isolated the HIV virus and, you know, proved its existence conclusively to the world and showed what it looked like. And of course, there would be lots of funding and, you know, prestige, and all things would flow to people who discovered it first. So the, and of course, all these laboratories work in great secrecy, so that they're not telling their methods, their methodology to other laboratories and everything, because it's proprietary information that they're going to use to be the first to reach the finishing line. And they were working feverishly at it for months, and then in the end, two laboratories, one in the States and one in England, isolated the virus at exactly the same time. Till this day, each one claims that they got there first, but there's no real, no one knows who got there first. Now that's fascinating, because that happened, you know, that's one example, but it happens so often in the scientific world, so often, that people work on a problem for years and years, and independently, and all of a sudden, many people come to the conclusion, the same conclusion, at the same time, simultaneously, very closely together, in different places and different things. And it is almost, one gets a sense that it's almost like this knowledge didn't exist in the world, this ability didn't exist in the world, now it came down into the world, now it exists, and once it's common domain, everybody has the ability to plug in and access that information. So that's why I believe that there is something as a collective consciousness, because that story, which that is a very well documented, like an accurate story that they tell about Rabbi Yosef Cairo, which has been preserved and passed on, and is based on Kabbalistic teachings, so therefore, you know, I'm sure that there is such a thing as a collective consciousness. And in the Kabbalah, we know that there's a certain level of the soul, the deepest level of the human soul in Kabbalistic teachings is actually one. There is no, you know, I have my own soul, you have your soul, whatever, it's different souls. But on the deepest level of my soul is called in Hebrew Yechida. Yechida means unity. And the deepest level of everyone's soul is called Yechida. But Yechida of everyone's soul is actually one. There is no, it is unity. Everybody's soul is connected to the same Yechida. And that's how, what they call mems, that's how these ideas can come into the world through one person and can instantly be found all over the place. And the key is being the first. Like, that's the hardest for the trailblazer who makes the path. That's the most difficult thing. Once the path has been made by the first person who goes through it, then he opens up the way and everybody can follow along. So one thinks of Roger Bannister, who ran the first 4-minute mile. Now, before he did that, people thought that there was some physical limitation, physiological limitation, that human beings could not run a mile in under 4 minutes. That was considered an impossible feat. And today, elite athletes do it all the time. I mean, every day there's somebody running a mile in under 4 minutes. It's like nothing today. And yet, till what? It's faster than me, let me tell you. It's a lot. It would be a physical impossibility for me to run a 4-minute mile. But it is not a physical limitation of human beings, just my own problem, nobody else's. Not everyone else's. Now you have to be a pretty elite athlete to do it. But the point is, people do it all the time today. Until he did it, it was considered impossible. People got pretty close. As he did it, there was an Australian who did it within days. And like, the guy had a cold or something the day that Bannister did it, but he was supposed to run too. He probably would have done it then as well. He was cheated out of being the first. See, I don't even know his name. but everyone knows Bannister, right? So the point is that you want to be the first, but to be the first, to have broken that 4-minute mile, was really an incredible achievement. Once he did it, that made it psychologically at least and possible, and I want to go maybe even a step further and saying even physiologically possible for other people to do it. But to be the first is always the most difficult. Once we understand that idea, a lot of problems in Judaism fall away, if you can understand that one idea. So let me just take one issue and we'll see how this resolves this issue when we understand this concept. You know, it's coming up faster than we think is going to be Rosh Hashanah. And on Rosh Hashanah, we're going to open up our machzors, our prayer books, our sidurim, and we're going to see that much of the liturgy is focused on the story of Abraham almost sacrificing his son Isaac on Mount Moriah, where God said, take up your son, and he willingly went and was willing to offer his son up as a carbon, as a sacrifice. Then an angel stopped him the last minute and said, don't do it, you passed the test. And we say, if you look at our liturgy on Rosh Hashanah, we say, God, remember that great, magnificent act of devotion of Abraham that he almost sacrificed Isaac. And it's full of it because we have a tradition that actually took place on Rosh Hashanah. And we want to evoke that event when we're asking personally on Rosh Hashanah that God bless us with a good, sweet, healthy year and everything that we want for ourselves. So then we say, bless us not in our own merit if we don't merit a blessed year, but bless us in the merit of this great deed that Abraham did all the way back then. So here's my question. Did Abraham sacrifice his son? He did not. But in Jewish history, have there been parents who made that sacrifice, that ultimate sacrifice, that actually brought their sons and daughters up onto the altar only because they were Jewish and believed in Torah and were willing to give up their lives in order to remain true to Torah? Yes. There were many parents that did it. Not one, not two, not 100, not 1,000, but tens and tens of thousands of Jewish people. Sure. Much proof. Any Jew that was killed in the Holocaust was killed because they were Jewish. So there's 6 million verified stories right there. It's probably much higher than 6 million verified stories right there of people who were killed and executed for the sole reason that they were Jewish. The Holocaust was a little bit different to most of Jewish history in that no one was given a choice in the Holocaust. In the Holocaust, Jews were killed. But through most of history, the Spanish Inquisition, for example, being a famous example of that, where people were given a choice. If you converted to Christianity, good. If not, you would be burnt at the stake. And tens of thousands of Jewish people allowed themselves to be burned and their children. When I was, one of my highlights whenever I take tours to Israel is I like to take people to Chana and her 7 sons, where they buried in the cave that they buried near Tzvat, in the mountains of Tzvat, and to explain to people what the story of Chana and her 7 sons, where each son was told to bow down to a statue and refused and lost their lives. And the final, her younger son, the king said, you know what, I'll just drop a coin and just bend down to pick up the coin in front of the idol. And he'll say, you were bending down to pick up the coin. And he looked at his mother and she said, no, we don't bow down to an idol. And so he was killed too. And then Chana jumped up, went on top of a building, a rooftop, and she said, God, Abraham, you asked him to sacrifice his son. He was willing to do it, but he actually didn't. I actually sacrificed my 7 sons. And then she jumped off the building and she died. So, and she's buried there in Tzfat with her 7 sons, and you know we know where their burial place is. So yeah, there are tens of thousands of stories that we know documented of Jews that actually sacrificed their children. So why don't we fill our Rosh Hashanah liturgy with the story of Chana and her 7 sons? I think that is a greater sacrifice, because you know it's amazing that Abraham was going to do it, but he didn't in the end. In the end he withdrew, he was told to, and he did not sacrifice. He walked back with his son very much alive. And actually, from then his son went on to get married and have children and everything. So a whole lifetime came after that. Isaac lived. So the question is, why the focus, the singular focus on the Abrahamic story? And the answer is?
He's the first one.
Because he was the first. So the whole notion that a Jewish person is capable of giving up their lives for their Judaism, because they are committed to Judaism, where did that come from? We received it, we inherited that from the first. And the first was Abraham. That's why it's such a big deal. Because to be the first is the most difficult, and afterwards it's relatively easier for other people to follow along. So, you know, in my house, when I tell my children that they should put a coin in a charity box, so, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, how much do you think I'm solving world hunger with the 20 cents I'm putting into my charity box? Probably close to zero, right? We're not solving world hunger. So why go through the exercise? Why would I insist that my children regularly take a coin and put it into a charity box? What does that accomplish?
Train them.
It trains them. It's the trailblazing act. But it's not just training them. It's maybe there's some, you know, wealthy philanthropist who's about to, he's contemplating whether he's going to send a $10 million check to Africa, right? And he's saying, should I, shouldn't I, you know, it's been a tough year this year. You know, I remember once I went to a guy's house, a congregant's house, and it was a brand new house, and he brought me over to see it. And I thought it was an apartment building, but it's not, it's just one house. The guy was like built on the mountain, on Westmount, and just gorgeous, gorgeous home. And it must have 100 doors in it. So I tell him, well, we need to get mezuzahs, so we need to count how many doors. He says, mezuzahs, Rabbi, do you know how much this house cost me? I can't afford mezuzahs. I mean, I can't afford any mezuzahs. Rabbi, we have to upgrade all the cars this year to get the latest Mercedes-Benz, you know, mine, and then don't ask about the round-the-world cruise that I had to take my wife on because it was our 25th, 30th wedding anniversary, whatever it was. No, Rabbi, I don't have any money to buy mezuzahs right now. I'm a little bit strapped, you know. Like, okay, everything's relative, but you know, I mean, I think his indoor swimming pool was bigger than my whole house by a factor. Anyway, so I look. That is, the thing is, there could be a philanthropist ready to write that $10 million check, and he doesn't know if he should write it or not. And he's ambivalent. You know, it's been a tough year relative to what he considers a tough year. Should he write that $10 million check or shouldn't he? And then all of a sudden, he gets a... he says, okay, I'll sign it. Now, it could be that that New York philanthropist decided to go and sign that check because my 18-month-old put a coin into a charity box. You see, if you buy into this idea of a collective consciousness, it's a collective morality as well, right? It's collective intelligence, it's collective consciousness, it's a collective morality. So if I get my kid to be the most compassionate, even if he has to break his nature, because let's say he's more of a selfish person, and I want him to become more compassionate, more giving. And so we emphasize that. And he works hard on his little self, right? His 18-month-old self. And he learns how to share his toys with his siblings. And that's a big accomplishment for him. Who knows if that doesn't make somebody in China be a little bit more compassionate.
Yeah, they are learning.
Or Indonesia. You know, they don't poke the eye out, both eyes out of the cow. They only poke out one. You know, you never know the ripple effects that this can have. If there is a collective consciousness, if this idea is true, that then little actions that you and I do to discipline ourselves and to improve ourselves should never be seen exclusively in the context of this is what I'm accomplishing. Little me. And becoming a little bit better, but in the grand scheme of things, with all the evil that's out there, what does that make a difference? Never say that. Because you don't know what you're bringing into the collective consciousness through your actions and through your growth, your personal growth. So I think this is a remarkable idea that says that there is something very, that what we do does matter. The fact that Abraham did something made it easier for his children to have that level of commitment right throughout history. The fact that my child gives a $0.20 to a charity box in Australia, in Melbourne, Australia, could have a ripple effect in the world's consciousness and morality, way beyond that little boy in Melbourne. So so it's a wonderful idea, and that's why I'm inclined to see in the scientific literature that's trying to prove this, very hard to prove its existence, but where it seems to be indicating that this does exist, well, I think that it's reflective of some fundamental Kabbalistic ideas, and it makes a lot of things that have happened in Jewish history and that happen in our own lives make a lot more sense. So I think it's a very useful idea. Any questions, concerns, comments, criticisms? Collective.
Can I have a question? So how do you reconcile, on one hand, this idea of collective consciousness, but on the other hand, I mean, if we look at any Halakhic literature or Gaddic literature, nobody agrees, everybody has a different opinion. So how come, like, all the, say, rabbis or commentators didn't collectively and independently come to the same conclusion on any given issue, but they all think something different?
That's a brilliant question. That is a good question. So let me try and paraphrase the question just to see that I got the depth of it, kind of. It's a very deep question. You're saying correctly that in Talmudic literature is full of arguments. One rabbi says black, the other one says white, the third one says gray, and there's a lot of argument. That's the Talmud, it's arguing. In fact, it's reflected in the name in the name for the Jewish people. We are called B'nai Yisrael. And the word Yisrael means to fight with God, to argue with God. And that's what we do. We're arguing all the time. You open up any Talmudic passage and it's going to be an argument. Rav Huna says this, Rav Shimon says that, Rav Yehuda says that. Everybody's got a different opinion. Beis Shammai says this, Beis Hillel says that. So you're saying that if there's a collective consciousness, certainly, why would that not reflect in Torah study, in Torah literature?
I guess it's not so much, arguments in the Talmud, because they're in the process of discussion, but more like, the final conclusions that different rabbis or different communities come to, let's say different minhagim or different halakhot for studying Ashkenazim, this community, that community. So after, obviously there's different opinions, but why did Noel independently come to the same conclusions that the halakha goes like so?
Thank you. It's also a brilliant question. The thing I thought was your question, I think, is very deep, and this is also a deep question. Just back to the Global Consciousness Project for a second. There is a correlation between eggs, these random number generators, that are in close proximity to each other. They seem to correlate more than further. So the worst, or not worst, but the most uncorrelated, what's the word for it? The most...
Uncorrelated.
Okay.
That's a good word.
Is if you would put a random number generator on the equator, on one side of the Earth, and another random generator on the other side, that's where the correlation is zero. Anything else, and as they get closer, it gets the correlation goes higher. At 12,000 kilometers distance apart, that's when it really spikes, and they start correlating. Even though they're supposed to be totally random, they actually start correlating more. Now, there's all different theories about why that could be magnetic, electromagnetic energies in certain places or whatever. But be that as it may, there's definitely a distance thing over here. So the closer we are in distance, the more, there's little sub-collective consciousness, little communities of collective consciousness in different places. So I think that you could... make an argument that Ashkenazi, Sephardi, different types of minhagim or customs developed from specific geographical regions, that's not necessarily a contradiction to my thesis that I've been presenting today, I don't believe. What I thought your question was is why is there argument in the Torah? Shouldn't there be an absolute unity there? And there should be no argument, because that should be, if anything, a community, a collective community where everybody agrees perfectly with each other. That's what I thought your question was. Since it isn't, I'm glad, and I won't answer it, that's all. but it could be, it's interesting that halakha itself is the final verdict in a halakhic argument is connected with, in Kabbalistically, is connected with the essence of God. So there are certain levels of God and God's intelligence, which is the Torah, which are further down the road, and that's where you get arguments and everything. But when you touch the essence of God, it's like the essence of all of our souls, there's a certain unity that exists over there. And that unity is the final verdict in halakha, that there is no room at that level for different opinions. Halakha is halakha. This is what you do. This is either kosher or it's not kosher. It's allowed or it's not allowed.
Well, unless you've got halakha according to Rav A and halakha according to Rav B. So halakha for this community, halakha for that community.
That's minhag rather than halakha. This is really getting into a very fascinating discussion, which is where how the whole oral law works and et cetera, and how it works. So it's a great discussion, but we can be here for many, many sessions discussing it. So I just want to say how it plugs into this whole collective consciousness thing is, I think once you get to the final halakha, let's not talk about minhag, but let's talk purely about halakha now. Once you get to the final halakha, it's for a community, I'll throw that in, a halakha for a community, then you have touched a collective, a collective agreement on what the final verdict is. I think that I'm going to open up more Pandora's box than I'm going to close. So maybe we should have as a potential topic for one of our classes to discuss how halakha works. Like, how does it work? Like, why do different rabbis say that this is kosher, this isn't kosher, this is acceptable for one community, it's not acceptable for another community? Rabbi A says one thing, Rabbi B says another. And how does that all fit with this is God's will and desire, is that certain things be done in a certain way? Because halakha is, in the end analysis, we believe, is God's will for how people should behave. So that's a fascinating discussion, but probably for another time.
Just a question that, think about Roger Bannister getting under 4 minutes. How does it work just philosophically? Because there must be a limit, like humans can't run a mile in a second. It's definitely impossible.
Right.
But then when you look at how fast can they run it, and it just incrementally keeps on getting lower and lower.
Yes.
So if you follow that through, you will get to a second, but we know that you won't get to a second.
Well, not really, because it's slowing down.
So
it's longer now between, when a record is broken, let's say for running a mile, let's say it used to be that the record was broken every few months, and then it became every few years, and now the record stands for a decade, So since the records are being broken, we are obviously coming closer to some physical limitation. We're probably not there yet, and as training gets better and nutrition gets better and different things, and steroids get better, so as all these things improve, as they get better at hiding it, then, we will push the barriers, the barrier, but I think, like you say, a human can't run a mile in a second, but sound can travel that fast, and light can travel fast.
Potentially time travel to find erotic pictures, and surely we can time travel to about a second.
Yeah. But it's kind of like when you go
just
from California.
Just find a picture at the end of the mile.
When you fly from California to... I knew I shouldn't have told you that. When you fly from California to... other way around, eh? No, when you fly from Melbourne to California, so it's always funny... is it that way? Yeah, Melbourne to California... Is that the one where when you get there, it's the same day you left? Yeah. So when you fly back to California, you know, you leave on a Monday and you arrive there on a Monday at the same time. It's like, okay, you know, so it could be done, yeah.
But there must be some limits. When they get to that, there'll be some other factor they could tinker with and push it out a little bit further.
Yeah. That's what humans do. We tinkerers.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to be. God gave us a world, and he said, go forth and tinker. Or something like that. Maybe I'm misquoting it, but you know, that's what he wants us to do. He wants us to tinker with the world and to constantly, like, you know, run a mile faster and faster, and everything that comes from that, to improve our medicine, to improve our science, to improve our psychology, to improve our philosophy, to improve our spirituality, to improve our collective consciousness. That's why we're here, and that's what we're supposed to do. So. Everyone, go forth and tinker.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.